This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. On today's program, Kathleen and I are going to be discussing a recent article that caught my attention from the Wall Street Journal. It was called The Seven Deadly Sins of Investing. And why I think this is an important topic to cover, well, just take a look at what's happened over the last decade. We've had two bear markets in stocks. We have rising interest rates that are hurting bonds right now. And we've also had a downturn in real estate, especially residential housing. Most of the largest asset that many people have is their homes. So how you invest, avoiding pitfalls and mistakes going forward, are going to play a very important role in determining your success for retirement. Now, let's face it, no one's perfect, and we all make mistakes with our money and our investments. But the real issue is, do we repent and forsake our investment sins, or actually keep repeating them over and over again? So recognizing and learning from our investment mistakes and changing our investment behavior is the first topic we're going to discuss on today's program.
And our second topic today relates to two issues we've addressed in the past on the program, one of which is starting a business in retirement, and the second is moving to another state in retirement. So today, Jim is going to be talking with Chad Motre, who's a chief economist of the National Association of Manufacturers, about the best states for business. And as Jim has noted a couple of times in the past, states that are friendly to business also tend to have attractive tax structures and other economic pluses that can make them attractive states for people looking to relocate in retirement.
Why don't we begin talking about this? Now, it's no secret that you have heard Kathleen and I talk about over and over again the importance of having a plan or an investment philosophy, which was rather interesting because in the article in the Wall Street Journal, they said there are a number of ways that you can avoid the various pitfalls that people make in investing. At the top of the list was, you guessed it, investors need a hard and fast plan of their investment goals. And if they're working with somebody, they need to find a trusted advisor or family member to help weed through the decisions, and they need to stay on top, paying attention to not just short-term events, which really is what you see in the media today, but more focused on longer-term events. Because let's face it, if you're saving for retirement, you may be in your 20s, just starting out in life. You may be in your 30s, starting a family. Maybe you bought your first home. You now have kids, so you're thinking of college education. You know, retirement is often a distant goal. And so sometimes we ignore it in the short term. But the kind of things that we do up front, how we plan, and especially if we plan early enough, determines that long-term success. So it's no surprise, just as we have talked so often here on the program about the importance of having a plan, that was one of the conclusions reached by the authors of the Wall Street Journal, is basically you need to have a plan. Have somebody, an advisor, family member that you trust that can help sort through those decisions. And you need to pay a lot more attention on the long-term goals and not the day-to-day news that makes the headlines or the actions in the market.
Well, Jim, as you and I have talked about a number of different times, a plan basically keeps you focused and keeps you from getting torn by fear or greed or anything else as you look at what's happening in the markets. And the first investing sin Kirsten Grind, the author of this article we're talking about, mentioned is the greed of lust. And she basically equates this with looking at short-term performance only versus taking a look at the intermediate term and long-term performance for investments. So, Jim, if you're someone who's looking to make a new investment and you only focus on the short-term performance, what sort of impact does that have on your overall portfolio?
Kathleen, we see this in a lot of the financial media is always telling you what's hot or what's not. And the problem with chasing performance, and especially recent performance, without looking at investments, historical behavior, how stocks have done, bonds have done, diversification, etc., what it often means is that you pick up an investment at or near its peak. In other words, if one particular sector or one asset class is the top performing asset class or sector, investors tend to gravitate towards that and bid it up. And usually it's closer to a peak. A good example is if we take a look at market performance this year in the first part of the year as stocks were going up, it was amazing because the stocks that were driving the market peak were not the typical type of sectors that you would see in an expanding market or an expanding economy. They were more on the defensive side, things like utilities, consumer staples, and healthcare. And it got to the point, Kathleen, as people were chasing yields, that the valuations on a lot of these stocks, especially in the utility sector, got to levels that bordered on almost bubble-like. And what happened is when the Fed began to talk about taper beginning in early May and the markets corrected, well, the sectors that got hit the hardest were exactly those that were outperforming the rest of the market. So just as money began to pour into the utility sector, consumer staples, they went through a major correction. And that's one of the problems that you have when you're chasing things that are currently the hot investment or the hot sector. It almost guarantees you're probably going to buy at a top. What you really want to do is take a look at what's underperforming and see if there are any factors like economic trends that would bode well for an underperforming sector going forward that would push that area or stock to move up in the months or perhaps the years again. One of the themes that we're seeing play out in the U.S. economy is a manufacturing renaissance and also a renaissance in energy. But it is applying to only certain sectors that benefit directly. And some of those sectors have not been hot recently, which also makes them more attractive for purchase. But the point being here is the investment industry comes at you as an investor. You see it on the cover of magazines, hot topics at the beginning of the year, the best sectors to invest in, or you'll see it mid-year, top performing funds, top performing sectors to invest in now. Just remember, usually what you're doing is chasing performance and looking through the rearview mirror.
I was thinking, Jim, you know, this sin of investing lust in quotes or chasing performance really gets compounded by the second investment sin that she mentions, which is pride, which is when you're not willing to acknowledge your investment philosophy is just not in sync with what's going on in the markets. So you keep investing based on past assumptions that may no longer be true, but you keep waiting and waiting and waiting for those assumptions to be true. So your underlying assumptions about the markets and the economy have to be on point or your investments won't make any sense.
Yeah, I think, Kathleen, a great example of this is peak oil, which we were proponents. Now, nearly everyone that listens to the Financial Sense NewsHour over the last decade or few years know that I'm a believer in peak oil. But in the past, I have heavily weighted my clients' portfolios towards energy based on this viewpoint, but over the last several years, economic trends have changed, energy consumption patterns have also changed. The U.S. is consuming about 2 to 3 million barrels less a day, and extraction technology with horizontal drilling, fracking, has also changed with the shale oil play. So while I still believe that we are at some point in the future are going to pass peak production, especially what I call cheap oil production, which is what we're seeing today, even though the price of oil is roughly close to $110 a barrel, not $150 as it was in the summer of 2008. Just take a look at what we're paying at the pump. We're still paying over $4 for a gallon of gasoline. So the era of cheap energy is over. But I don't view it as an imminent threat. So we've adjusted client portfolios to allocate to energy. And I want to go back to a point about chasing performance, which surprised a lot of people. I mean, gold peaked in the fall of 2011. Silver peaked in the spring of 2011. Just as everybody was jumping into gold, we were moving into a disinflationary environment. Things were improving in the U.S. The dollar was getting stronger. And this was an example after a long period of time where gold was making the headlines, people were jumping in record amount of buying and investing in this sector just as it peaked. In contrast, what we've seen since that time is a big drop in price that I think, at least at this point, is providing better buying opportunities.
I think what you're pinpointing here, Jim, is that it's not enough to just have a philosophy and stick to the philosophy, but also being a little flexible with your thinking and realizing when things have changed and making adjustments. But I think what this also assumes, Jim, is that the investor is somehow actively participating in what's going on in their portfolios. And I think, you know, the third sin that Kirsten mentions is the sin of sloth. Or sloth, depending on if you're English or from America, how you say that. But basically, being apathetic or not caring or not just not paying attention to what's going on in your portfolios. And I think this is a pretty big sin I think a lot of us fall prey to, just because it seems like a kind of a hassle to keep a finger on what's going on with our money.
You know, you bring up a good point, Kathleen, because we see this play out so often in 401k plans at work. You know, they're set up for an automatic withdrawal from your paycheck. And usually what happens, most companies provide you with a set of funds. You pick out, let's say, out of $100, I want 20% going into this fund, 25% going into this fund, etc. And once that allocation is made, now some plans do not allow you to change frequently or to do market timing, but typically what happens is an allocation is made and it pretty much gets put on automatic pilot, even though, for example, economic circumstances or market fundamentals may change considerably. People just allow those things to take place and, you know, it's on automatic pilot. They don't look at it. And maybe about the only time they really do look at it is when you go through a severe downturn, as we did, for example, between 2008 and 2009, which really caught investors' attention because the markets fell by over 40%. And of course, we had the headlines of the financial crisis. And the other thing, too, is the fees charged can be a real drag on performance. So it's important to know how much you're being charged by whoever's managing your assets and whether or not the fee you're getting real value for your money.
Jim, how would I know if I'm getting real value for the management fee I'm paying on the mutual funds in my 401k, for example? How would I measure that?
Well, I think you have to take a look at performance yardsticks, how well the particular fund is done against its benchmark. And remember, different funds have different benchmarks. If you're in a large cap fund, you probably want to compare yourself to the Dow Industrials or the S&P, a small cap fund, the Russell 2000, an international fund, the Morgan Stanley International Equity Index. So there's various benchmarks, but then also the degree of service that you get for the money invested. In other words, if you're working with the financial advisor, does that financial advisor make themselves available to you if you have questions regarding your account or maybe the markets or financial issues at hand? So it depends on the level of service that you're getting, the response that you're getting, especially when we go through market fluctuations. So there are a lot of things that go into this mix, knowing the appropriate benchmark and then also knowing the level of service.
I was also thinking too, Jim, there's been an awful lot of press recently about how passively managed funds have outperformed actively managed funds over the past 10 or 15 years. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, in a bull market between 1980 and the year 2000, when the bull market ended, that might have been the case. But, you know, Kathleen, if you take a look at up until recently this year, the S&P was no further at the beginning of the year than where it was 13 years ago. So had you been in an index fund and just reinvested, you would have barely break even at the end of a decade. So when you go through bear markets, as we've done, let's say, between 2000, 2002, and then let's say 2007 and 2009, you know, passive investments don't work. It's great if you're in a long-term upward bull market as we were in the 80s and 90s. It doesn't work as well when you have bear markets, especially two bear markets, as we did in the last decade.
I was thinking too, Jim, it seems like a lot of people, while I think it's important to keep on top of your investments and make adjustments as necessary, I notice investment behavior that seems to be a lot more about panicking and pulling money out of funds. And so I think part of this too is just if you're constantly pulling your money in and out of funds and in and out of an approach, you're never going to get ahead. You're always going to be chasing something else instead of seeing if what you're doing really works. And I think part of this is due to greed. You know, people really always want to follow what's the most popular investment idea. So they sort of, as we've talked recently about doing, they pick what's sort of popular now and not look at the fundamentals of the particular investment or whether or not it even fits in with their overall portfolio plan for themselves. So they sort of have this mentality, well, everyone else is doing it. I want to do it too, which is, you know, gold, which you mentioned was a perfect example of that.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of money, for example, leave bond funds over the last couple months. I mean, this is the third quarter that bond funds have lost money. And I think that's a new experience for a lot of investors because, Kathleen, after the financial crisis since 2009, the bulk of the money of individual investors have gone into bond funds. So most listeners know, at least right now, I'm not a fan of bond funds due to the interest rate risk. You know, on the day we're talking, the 10-year Treasury note is at 2.9%. It started out the beginning of the year at 1.6%. You take a look at some of the bond funds that are very popular with investors like TLT. I mean, there's been some serious losses here. I mean, TLT is down 13% for the year, including dividends. And that is something I think investors are not used to. But I've also seen investors pull out of individual bonds as well, mostly because they've seen their individual bond market values go down. And I understand that, you know, if interest rates go up in the short term, a bond will fluctuate in price. So that's understandable. But in a sense, when you're holding an individual bond, it's an entirely different matter than, let's say, a bond fund, because the market value is only right now. What you're more concerned about is what is going to be the market value when that bond matures. And if you own a high-quality bond, when it matures, you're going to get 100% of your money. So regardless of whether the bond market value goes above par or below par a dozen times between now and the maturity date, number one, it's going to pay you back your original principal when it comes due. And if you bought it at a discount, you may have a gain. So if I bought a $100,000 3% bond or a 2.5% treasury bond, it's now worth $99,000 in the open market. In 3 years, when it comes due, it's going to be a $100,000 bond, not the $98,000 market value. So 3 years from now, it really doesn't matter because at maturity, it pays back its face value as long as I hold it. And let's not forget, the income that you're going to receive from this bond never changes. If you have a 3% bond, it's going to pay you 3% until that bond matures. It doesn't change. It doesn't get reduced like a bond fund. So you can worry about the value of your bonds. I guess if there was a worry there, the worry would be the creditworthiness of the issuer. And if that would be the case, you know, you can avoid that by simply buying high quality bonds. That way, there's less to worry about and less anxiety. But really, what we see happen, Kathleen, just like chasing performance, we've seen it happen in bond funds and bonds themselves, this herd mentality that drives these massive inflows and outflows to and from bond funds and stock mutual funds. Investors get spooked. They start to sell, then everybody piles in, and at the same time, on the buy side. So it's better to have a plan, adjust it slightly, then constantly changing your investment strategy based on the prevailing market sentiment, what's hot now, what's not hot, or get scared by some media overplay on a particular event. A good example was the fiscal cliff issue that was so played upon in the final months of last year. It turned out to be a big brouhaha over nothing. It got solved in the final wee hours of the morning. The market took off, and the U.S. did not default. So just a good example of this kind of mentality of chasing performance and paying so much attention to short-term events that get overplayed in the media.
I think what's really interesting here, Jim, is we've been talking about the herd mentality and basically following and doing what everyone else is doing. I feel like there's a flip side to that that investors often get attracted to, which is the exclusivity mentality. I want to be part of the inside club of investors that only know about this specific special investment. And Kristen Grind, the author of this article in the Wall Street Journal, calls this a sin of envy. In other words, that you're envying an exclusive group of investors that you want to be part of. And we've seen this happen a lot because I think there's this mentality that if an investment is exclusive, or insider, somehow it's got to be better than what everyone else, in quote, knows about.
Yeah, it sort of goes along with I'm going to get rich quick schemes, you know, this exclusive investment, you know, put all your money in one area, whether it's gold, it's real estate or tech stocks like in the 90s. You see this too with certain types of hedge funds or limited partnerships or, let's say, non-publicly traded real estate investment trusts or even IPO stock offerings. A good example was the Facebook offering that came out. It was hot. Everybody wanted to get in on it. It was going to be the next Microsoft, the next Google. And for about 6 to 7 months, anybody got in on the initial offering or tried to buy it afterwards took a 40 and 50% beating. It's only until recently that Facebook has gotten back to its original IPO price. So like all investments, this sort of seemingly exclusive idea, you need to have a purpose in your portfolio before you consider them. You know, there may be an allowance or a portion of money that you speculate with, but the investment needs to be able to stand on its own merits. And once again, regardless of how special they seem, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, as so many people tend to do. We see them put all in cash and gold or all in bonds and gold, and they fail to diversify. I mean, a lot of people, Kathleen, have missed this 150% gain in the stock market and have not realized that, you know, and they're waiting around for a dollar crash, which is not going to happen.
Now, thinking about exclusive investments, Jim, do you remember when we started getting all those calls for a while about the Iraqi dinar? We had a lot of people who were convinced that, you know, that was going to be the investment of choice for the insiders that were in the know. And I can't even remember how many calls I got about people asking me, hey, how can I invest with the Iraqi dinar? And I just found it pretty ironic that that was sort of the exclusive investment go-to for a while. It didn't seem to have a whole lot of merit to me.
No, it didn't. And, you know, every year we get something like that. And especially with the advent of the internet, there's something that becomes hot or a concept or a conspiracy. That was just one of many, and I'm sure we'll get a lot more in the future. But if you can't resist the latest and greatest limited access investment, maybe restrict yourself in the type of ventures to a small portion of your portfolio. I mean, there's nothing wrong if you want to take a small percentage of your portfolio, I would say no more than 5% on the maximum side, and invest it into things that, you know, you want to speculate with. But know this, that you are speculating, and understand, in addition to maybe the possibility of making some big bucks, you could lose all your investment.
And I think this brings up a really good point, Jim, which is it's really important to know when you have made an investment mistake and to cut your losses. One of the sins that Kristen mentions in this article is a sin of wrath, or not being able to acknowledge when you've made an investing mistake. And part of the trick to investing is to know when to back away from an investment that's going sour. If I'm an investor and I have a stock that's not performing the way I think it should be, how do I know when to let it go?
First of all, you need to know why you invested in that investment. What were the drivers? What were the fundamentals that you were hoping to get from this investment? So if the fundamental reason to let go of a bad investment, such as poor earnings trends, an unsuccessful change in management, or the market strategy changes, for example, but you can also limit losses by looking at the stock's historical performance and then targeting points at which it looks like the stock starts to go into decline. I mean, nothing goes straight up. I mean, a good example was this year. I mean, if you looked at a chart of the utility index, it was going up every single week. It seemed like you couldn't lose on this investment. So just remember, when something goes up precipitously, as we saw in many of those income-oriented sectors at the beginning of the year, and it starts to go into decline, maybe taking some of your profits off the table, or before you make an investment, set a target gain at which you plan to sell the stock, especially if you are keeping up and the fundamentals begin to deteriorate, either in the economy or, let's say, in the business the company is invested in, let's say that sector. So this loss may have more to do with your risk tolerance than price history, which is okay. And you need to stay disciplined enough to make those sells at those target dates and not get greedy. So if you've seen a stock that run up 40, 50, 60%, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking some money off the table. You know, it's very hard for investors to admit a loss. There's been a lot of psychology studies on investors and their investment philosophy and behaviors. And one of the worst things that investors have to deal with is losses. It's kind of like, well, I'm admitting a failure. And you will find, Kathleen, whether you're reading Jack Schwager's Market Wizards or some of the most successful investors, even Warren Buffett, when they make a mistake, they make a mistake, they learn from it, they get out of their investment. And so along with investment success, not every investment that you're going to make is going to turn out to be successful. And you have to know when to cut your losses. As Kenny Rogers said, you need to know when to hold them and when to fold them.
When to walk away and when to just flat out run. Jim, I think this kind of brings up the whole idea of what we've been talking about since the beginning of this particular segment, which is the need to have a plan. If you have a plan, you understand why certain things are in your portfolio. So you have a better idea of when and why to sell them and when and why to buy them. One of the things, again, that this article points out is that a lot of the problem people have right now is because they don't have a plan, they're guilty of gluttony or spending all their cash now instead of saving it for later. And she quotes this pretty scary statistic in her article when she says that 57% of U.S. workers surveyed by the Employee Benefit Research Institute earlier this year reported less than $25,000 in total household savings. You know what that says to me, Jim? It says that most working Americans have not thought about retirement in concrete, real terms, like where am I going to live? What am I going to do with my time in retirement? And how much is this all going to cost?
You know, this is really dangerous because it's more likely in the future that there's going to be some entitlement reforms with Social Security, welfare, etc., as the government will be forced to cut back on the amount of money that it spends because there simply won't be the revenues to support it. So I think the fact that people do not have a plan, and, you know, let's face it, if you're young, just starting out in life, you're probably thinking, okay, I'd like to own my own home. Maybe you're starting a family, thinking of college education, and retirement is sort of this thing that's way, way off in the distance. But we've done a program on this in the past where we talked about the earlier you start, the less money that you need to put aside because your investments are going to be compounding over a longer period of time. So spending all your money now and not learning to put money aside for the future, yeah, it's great. You get immediate gratification, but it means you're going to have to put a lot more aside the further off you put off saving for retirement. The fewer years you have to save for retirement, the more you'll have to put aside.
Jim, what do you think would really inspire or give people motivation to start saving and investing for the future? What do you think would help them sort of feel motivated to do that?
I think having a concrete idea of what they're going to be spending in the future and how much they'll have to save to be able to spend that amount. So putting a real dollar figure out there in terms of total savings target as well as an annual savings target. I always like things like 401k programs or automatic savings programs, Kathleen, because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. It just becomes a budget item like paying your utilities or your rent or house payments. So yes, you know, we're back to the idea of putting together a budget. I know it's probably not everybody's favorite topic, but you know, knowing how much you spend and a balance sheet, knowing what you have in assets, what you owe, knowing how close or how far you are from, let's say, meeting those savings goals, your cash flow, knowing how much extra income there is in the budget to save, gives you a better chance to plan and allocate where the money goes. Does it go for saving for emergency? How much will it go for the kids' future education? How much is it going to go for retirement? And you can sit down and prioritize as each one of those goals are fulfilled.
Well, Jim, I think it really wouldn't be lifetime income if we didn't mention a budget somewhere in the podcast. So we're getting back here to the basic budget again. It's the most concrete number you can start with to figure out what you should be saving. And really, we can't do much without it. Got to start with that budget somehow.
Yeah, I think this, aside from the budget, it really gets to setting goals. Every business has a budget. They have goals that they set for the year. It's no different than anybody that's planning their future, whether it's retirement, buying their first home, or education for their children. But I think the goal has to be specific. It has to be quantified. And you also have to have a time frame. That's pretty much what retirement planning, Kathleen, when you boil it down to its simple essence, is all about.
Just basic goal planning. And, you know, we talk a lot about having a retirement income plan drives your investments, but we also need to point out that it drives basically any financial goal that you have, whether it's to buy a home or fund education or save for a special business or a big trip or special occasion, that basically the same principle of budgeting and planning and timelining and specificity applies to basically any financial goal that you have.
And not being sidetracked by some of those investment sins along the way. Don't forget, the kind of decisions you make, it's not just having a plan, but also making sure you adhere to that plan. You adjust it as your own circumstances change, job loss, job promotion, business success, etc. Or, for that matter, the economy changes like it did going through the crisis of 2000, 2002, in 2007 and 9. So, you really don't want to get sidetracked, get caught with investment fads, current headlines, but focus more on your long-term plan.
So, Jim, that's what we have here. We have the seven investing sins. So just to repeat, avoid chasing performance, avoid staying stuck in an outmoded strategy, pay attention to your investments, avoid doing what everyone else is doing, avoid doing what you think the insiders are doing, hanging on to investments that have may already had their day, or, and this is the cardinal sin, of being guilty of a failure to plan.
Or to focus on keeping it positive on the do's instead of the don'ts, look for things that are poised to perform rather than those that are already, let's say, outperforming. Stay flexible with your strategy and your thinking, and also pay attention to your investments and the cost involved. So what makes sense rather than what's in or hot? We spend so much time talking about current fads. And more importantly, make a plan for yourself and your money.
I just want to say thanks again to Kristen Grind for her article on the seven deadly sins of investing. Really good stuff in there. So definitely worth a read on WallStreetJournal.com. And coming up next, the second topic of our broadcast, the best states for business with Chad Motre, chief economist at the National Association of Manufacturers. And Chad points out that there are states that are friendly for business, which means that they tend to have attractive tax structures, good university systems from which to pull employees, reasonable cost of living. So again, retirees thinking about relocating when they retire or relocating now may want to tune in to see where might be some good places to live that might have a cheaper cost of living and a cheaper tax structure.
And coming up next, I'll be speaking with Chad Motre at the National Association of Manufacturers about business-friendly states coming up right after this. Joining me on the program as my special guest is Chad Motre. He is an economist at the National Association of Manufacturers. And Chad, you recently put out a report on some of the top states for doing business in 2013. And I wonder, before we get into who's at the top within those 50 states, if you would tell us or explain some of the criteria that you use to make these judgments.
You know, we were primarily just looking at the states that have the most manufacturing jobs, which were added in not just since the recession, but also in the last year. So we're looking pretty much exclusively at Bureau of Labor Statistics data from at least since the end of the recession. So it would be at least since the end of 2009.
When you take a look at some of those, I'm just looking at some of the things. The cost of doing business, where you take a look at, let's say, local taxes, individual income, property taxes, business taxes. Then you take a look at, for example, the economy, how diverse it is, the big players. Another important element that you looked at was infrastructure and transportation. Obviously, if you're going to start manufacturing goods, you want to be able to get it on a train or waterway or someplace, the workforce, and then also some quality of life issues in, of course, one that I'm sure all businesses are concerned about, which is business friendliness, which relates to regulation and litigation. Can you expound on some of these?
You know, obviously, at the National Association of Manufacturers, we're obviously a national organization, trade association. But, you know, we obviously are focused on many of the topics that you just mentioned. So when you're looking at manufacturing jobs, which is primarily what we would be looking at, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that manufacturing has one of the largest spillover effects of any sector that's out there. So for every $1 spent in the manufacturing sector, you actually get another $1.48 in indirect benefits. So that's a pretty huge multiplier. It's one of the reasons why so many states are going out and making sure that they can keep their manufacturing sectors flourishing. And it's part of, I think, a change in just a few years ago. People weren't really focusing on manufacturing jobs. I think there was a big incentive, or at least overall conversation, about maybe we shouldn't make things in America anymore. You know, that was really kind of a train of thought that was kind of ingrained in conventional wisdom. And instead, now I think you're now having a larger appreciation for the manufacturing sector and its economic benefits. And, you know, one of the ways that states obviously can continue to reach out and attract those types of jobs is, you know, by looking at their tax and regulatory environments and making sure they have a workforce that is, you know, prepared to go into some of those sectors. And, you know, in each of those areas, the NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, at least at the national level and to the extent we can, partnering with states, we look to make sure that there is a focus on those types of issues. I forgot trade in that mix. But, you know, each of those, I think, is important for states to be able to grow their manufacturing sector.
Chad, are you seeing something that there's a new theory that is being expounded by many economists and investment houses is what is called insourcing? You know, we've heard so much for multiple decades that companies were leaving the U.S., locating overseas. Now we're hearing stories, for example, like Apple is spending $100 million. They're building 3 factories here. Are you seeing this trend? Would you validate that?
Definitely, we're seeing it. I think that you're seeing a lot of increased investment in the United States. I think that the real shift in focus over the last couple of years is that many businesses are actually looking at the U.S. as a viable location to be able to set up facilities. And again, that wasn't the case a few years ago. And there are many things which really are changing that. Number one, costs are obviously higher overseas. We're having many manufacturers who are saying that their costs in China and elsewhere have been going up pretty rapidly. At the same time that's happening, transportation costs are higher. And here in the U.S., we continue to see a lot of productivity gains, which have helped keep our overall labor costs much more competitive. Other issues which are cited for reasons for that increased investment include energy. I think, you know, the real game changer over the last couple of years is the explosion of shale and the exploration of shale and the impact that that's having on U.S. domestic energy production. Manufacturers consume 30% of all of the energy in the U.S., so we want to make sure that we can do whatever we can to keep those costs lower, and we're seeing a lot of investment, primarily because of energy costs. And the other reason that we often hear, of course, is quality, and that, you know, sometimes it's easier to manage or control quality when it's closer to home. And so, yes, I think the answer to your question is we are seeing increased investments in the U.S. in the manufacturing sector, and I think that that's given us much more of a bullish attitude moving forward than I think than a lot of conventional wisdom might have had us a couple of years ago.
And Chad, are you seeing this return to manufacturing? Are you seeing it concentrated in the way of your surveys? In other words, I know that Apple, which is based out of California, they're not building their new factories here. They're building them in Texas and they're building them elsewhere where the business climate is a lot more friendly. Is this what you're seeing in the manufacturing sector? In other words, those companies that are building new plants, even foreign as well as domestic, they're going to those states where all of these qualities are present?
I think that there are obviously investments in all 50 states, but I think that you're right. I think on the margins, you have a lot of states who are very aggressive about their enticements to get manufacturing production and investment there. So that includes things like taxes, looking at the tax rates, looking at the regulatory environment, the tort environment, and other factors of that nature. And I think one of the things to not lose sight of is that business conditions matter, both nationally and also at the state level. And you have states who are competing against each other. So you have to look at a whole host of these factors, and certainly manufacturers do when they're looking at location decisions. You know, where is it best for them?
Now, let's take a look at your survey and the results of it. At the very top of the list, you have a state here, South Dakota. Cost of doing business, the economy, infrastructure, which kind of surprised me because I know that it's not a very populous state. It's also a state that can get some pretty extreme temperatures.
Well, I think that you're referring not to the NAM survey, but the one from CNBC. And I know that they use some of our data in it. But I think, obviously, South Dakota has a lot of good things going on for it. Very close to North Dakota, for instance, where you have the shale explosion happening right above it. You also have an environment in South Dakota, which is, again, very business friendly. So I think that that certainly is one of the things which has really helped that state grow and certainly things for other states to emulate.
You know, one state that always appears on just about everybody's list is Texas. Not only are they experienced a renaissance in energy, but also in manufacturing. You've got, for example, Austin, Texas. You have a lot of the high technology companies, everybody from companies like eBay and even Apple that are moving into that region.
Well, you know, when you look at manufacturing job creation since the end of the recession, Texas is number two. It's only after Michigan. So obviously Michigan is benefiting from the rebound of the auto sector. But Texas is number two, and as you point out, they have a lot of really strong sectors there, high tech, as well as energy-related areas, as well as, you know, just a lot of investments taking place in Texas overall. When you look at overall non-farm creation, not just manufacturing, I think Texas is number one. So Texas, in terms of overall job creation, is doing a lot of things right.
So as we look at this list, from your perspective now, the report that I'm looking at was from CNBC, where they have South Dakota, Texas, North Dakota, Nebraska, Utah, Virginia, Colorado, Georgia, Wyoming, and Idaho as the top 10. And I want to bring up another thought here, Chad. Analyst Meredith Whitney has written a new book called The Fate of the States, and she's talking about that central corridor of the United States from Texas all the way up to North Dakota, from maybe Colorado to Indiana, is the new sort of emerging market. This is the place where you're seeing job creation, companies move in, very common characteristics, friendly tax regimes, balanced budgets, low regulation. Do you see that trend?
Certainly, I think there are a lot of things that are in that whole corridor. You certainly have a friendly business environment, which, as you mentioned, but you also have a lot of energy development that's taking place, especially in Texas, Oklahoma, all the way up to the Dakotas. You would even add some of that shale is also in Pennsylvania and Ohio. But in general, in that region that Meredith Whitney's describing, yeah, they're putting a lot of things together. I think in many ways that kind of mirrors the overall message I think that we'd like to convey nationally as well, and that is that we need to have a tax policy and a regulatory policy as well as a trade policy which continues to facilitate increased investment nationally, and I think some of those states are doing that at the state level as well.
When you look at states for doing business from your association, is there a criteria? In other words, are there one or two or three top things that you look at least for you, make it very appealing for companies to locate?
Well, I think the one thing that we haven't really talked about much in this interview yet, but I think it's important, is that almost every manufacturer that we talk to says that they're having trouble attracting and retaining quality talent. That even in a world where you have 7.5% unemployment rate, we don't have enough welders, mechanics, machinists, engineers, et cetera. And I think that states, I think, are recognizing this. And, you know, many manufacturers are trying to proactively work with the community colleges and their state governments to be able to change that picture around, to be able to increase those skills. Particularly when you look at the fact that many manufacturers, the average age of their workforce is over 50-something. So you know that in the next few years, especially as the sector grows and we have more retirements, there's going to be huge holes to fill in many of these. So I guess the one thing I would point out is that in addition to the tax and the regulatory environment and the, you know, overall business friendliness, things we've already talked about, I think the other component that's essential to that is the workforce itself. You know, if a business is locating in a specific state, they're going to be looking at the human resources that are there and making sure that, you know, they expect to do some training, but, you know, they want to make sure that the workforce is at least up to snuff in terms of being able to hire the workers that they're going to need.
You know, Chad, I know manufacturing is using a lot more automation today. So, you know, you picture somebody assembling something on the factory floor today. A lot of that is done with robots. So your average factory worker is going to have to understand computers, programming. So the skill set is much, much higher today, which relates back to the point you brought up about education. However, when you take a look at those states that have education, it's always been some of the most populous states who have now become business unfriendly. I think of California, UCLA, Stanford, USD. You take a look at Massachusetts, where you have MIT, Harvard, some of these Ivy League schools. But many of those states now, even though they have the education facilities, are business unfriendly.
Certainly those types of factors don't help their case any, even to the extent that they're doing innovation and education right. I think, you know, businesses won't necessarily give them a second look unless they can also get some of those other elements in place. And you're right, there's a lot of business unfriendliness there, at least a perception that they're unfriendly.
As you take a look at this, if you were to say three criteria, and is it any different, Chad, for a large business versus a small business? I mean, a large business, you know, somebody like a General Electric, they have a large lobby effort that they have in Washington, so they have access to politicians. But a lot of times your small businesses don't have that.
You're right. And certainly, I think when you look at the regulatory environment, for instance, I think that they disproportionately are burdened with a lot of the regulatory compliance. They just don't have a staff full of accountants and lawyers down the hall like a lot of other companies would. And so, you know, you definitely are looking at a lot of huge burdens, particularly on the small and medium-sized manufacturers. Keep in mind that two-thirds of manufacturers are not C corporations. They're actually pass-through entities. So they would pay their taxes at the individual level. And when they're looking at regulatory compliance, it certainly is a much greater burden for them than it is for the other companies, at least in terms of time and cost.
So, in other words, if you have a state that is more business-friendly, less regulatory burdens, let's say lower taxation, I would imagine, especially since a lot of these small businesses you're talking about are either single proprietors, partnerships, or sub-S corps, that those states that have that environment would be especially attractive for smaller businesses.
I would agree with that. I mean, to the extent that a manufacturer or any business has a choice of where they're going to locate, I think that the business environment matters big time.
Are there any states that you're aware of that, I know sometimes when you come out of a recession or states are actively recruiting, they'll make special tax incentives for businesses to relocate? We periodically get this in California where you get letters in the mail from, you know, like the governor of Texas saying, hey, come to our state and we'll give you some tax breaks.
Well, you definitely have, we talked about this earlier, I think states are competing against each other and it's a zero-sum game and some states are going to win at that, some states aren't. But you have some pretty aggressive players out there. And I think that's really where those types of incentives and the overall business environment matters. You know, you are going to have some pretty aggressive tactics that are being employed. And you are seeing certainly some increased investment in those states that are much more incentivizing those types of moves.
Would you say, Chad, coming out of the recession where, you know, a lot of states got hit pretty hard with their budgets, had to cut back, that there is now a concerted effort to woo businesses into their state? I think there's 9 states that don't have income taxes, and I think there's a couple right now that are trying to get bills passed in their legislature to remove or certainly reduce their income tax.
I agree with that. I think that you definitely are having some states, I'm not going to name them, but you certainly have some states that are out there that are certainly trying to advertise that they have the lowest taxes, they have the better overall business environment in terms of regulation, et cetera, and that, you know, you should move your business to my state. And I think that you certainly are seeing several governors and several economic development folks who are really trumpeting that.
Have you seen anything? I mean, on this list, you obviously have your top 10, and then you have your bottom 10, of which my own state of California happens to be one of them. But do you see any change on those states that have been traditionally unfriendly to business? Our state keeps getting more unfriendly with the realization that, wait a minute, we better hold on to what we have, because once a business packs its bags and moves, it's unlikely to come back. I think, Chad, of New York City in the 1970s, where you had, I think at one time, over 150 of the Fortune 500 companies were located in New York City. And because of regulation, crime, taxation, a lot of those companies moved out of the state. Same thing that's happening here in California today.
You certainly hope that people recognize that. You know, I was just in Michigan, and it appears that there's a much more of a stronger attitude towards business friendliness there now in terms of trying to attract investment. So, you know, you definitely have some turnarounds, and you hope that states recognize that these business conditions matter. But unfortunately, too many of them don't. And that's really where you continue to see kind of that continued erosion.
If our listeners would like to find out more information in terms of what states are the most business friendly, the type of attributes that the states would offer a potential business, do you have anything on your website that our listeners could go to that would at least inform them?
Well, you know, at least on the national level, you know, if they're interested in more information, just go to our website, www.nam.org. So that's nam.org. And we can always connect them with folks in the states. We have obviously affiliated members in each of the states, as well as, you know, we have a pretty robust national agenda to try to increase manufacturing activity in the U.S. in general.
Well, listen, Chad, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. It's at least, I think, some good news. For so many decades, we've been hearing about companies outsourcing, relocating factories. It's nice to know that that trend is reversing.
You're right. It is great news. It's nice to be talking about a growing manufacturing sector again.
Chad, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you. Nice to be on.
Well, that concludes my interview with Chad Moutre from the National Association of Manufacturers. I wanted to get Chad on the program because on our weekend edition, we've been talking about a manufacturing renaissance. And as you heard in that interview, Chad was talking about many of the issues that are now attracting not only U.S. corporations back to the United States, but also foreign companies as well. A lot of your major foreign car manufacturers are building plants here. Airbus is building a wing here. But also those states that make it attractive for manufacturing, in other words, low taxation, low regulation, access to education, healthcare facilities, cost of living, believe it or not, those same states also make it attractive for retirement. So in many ways, the two of them blend together. So it's kind of interesting. This is one more piece in the puzzle. Over the last year, we've been talking about this manufacturing renaissance that's taking place in the U.S. We had Meredith Whitney here. Her thesis is that the Central Corridor of the United States is going to become the next emerging market in this next decade. And little by little, we're seeing more pieces of evidence that are supporting that thesis. Well, on behalf of myself and Kathleen Harris, we'd like to thank you for joining us on this week's Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.